This is Pearland Podcast. Today I'm in New York. Sitting beside me is Tim Snyder, who has his column, The Gray Market. Tim, can you briefly introduce yourself?
Sure. So, as you said, my name is Tim Snyder. I have been an art journalist for, at this point, well, more years than I care to think about. But I started off in the art world in my early 20s. I worked in galleries, starting off as a front desk assistant, then becoming a registrar, and then doing client management, all a bunch of other different things. And then eventually I started writing about the business side of the art world from the standpoint of somebody who had been inside of it, because a lot of people who cover the art market as journalists have not worked in it in any other capacity. And so I hope that having the perspective of somebody who had been behind the scenes a little bit more might be able to provide something that wasn't already a part of the conversation as much.
10 years in the gallery world?
Give or take. I did a couple of stints. I worked for about 7 years originally, then I left for a little while, then I came back for about a year and a half. So all told, it's like 9 years.
What prompted you actually to start this gray market column or this gray market blog? Because, I mean, just now we were discussing about it and you were saying that you start the blog first.
Right, right. It started as a blog in 2013 because at that point I had basically no profile in the larger art world outside of the job that I had had, the people that had dealt with me in that capacity. So it wasn't as if I could just step out and start pitching things to the New York Times,
to
the art newspaper.
But you were in the gallery world. Mm-hmm. I mean, you start from the really, really the bottom as a front desk and all that. But after 9 years, mm-hmm. what prompted you to change everything and then start writing? The market was so frustrating working in a gallery that you want to take all your experience and whatever, I mean, what you have been confronting and put it in a blog with an analysis?
Yeah, it's a couple of different things. One, I had been writing very seriously, just in a different format up to that point. I had moved to LA after I graduated from college and I was working to be a screenwriter. So the whole time that I was working in the gallery, I was also working as a screenwriter with my older brother, who is still a screenwriter today. But after a while, I eventually reached a point where I felt like that wasn't the best thing for me, but I wanted to write about something. I wanted to try to add something to the conversation. And I reached this pivot point where I thought, well, maybe this is something that I could do that would really kind of make more of an impact. So that was one side of it, just the general desire to write for a living. And then on top of that, I had made a bunch of friends in LA who were artists. And to hear them talk about how they thought things worked behind the scenes, in a lot of cases, it was so far outside of the reality of what it was. And so I was spending, I don't want to say a lot of time, but certainly you're having drinks with people. You're just talking about how your lives are going. They're talking about like, oh, I just need to get a gallerist. If I can just get a gallerist, then everything will be okay. And I'm like, guys, I don't think that that's actually the solution. Like, maybe that's going to help. Maybe, certainly. But I think that there was this attitude that if you could just get represented, then that was going to take care of everything that existed outside of the studio. And I can see you kind of smiling in a knowing way over there. And I think that you can speak even better than I can to the fact that that just opens a whole other door.
Yeah. And then, okay, so after all these years of working in a gallery, writing about it, and then you were writing for ArtNet, and then subsequently today, you're writing for art newspaper. So what do you see this whole dynamics about art market?
I just think it's a fascinating space. I mean, I come from a background that has nothing to do with the formal art world. My mom was a public school teacher. My dad was effectively an IT guy at like an industrial company. And I loved art when I was growing up. I wanted to be involved in it in some capacity. But there's a huge difference between the way that you think all this stuff works before you experience it, and the way that it actually works once you get inside of it. And I'm just perpetually intrigued by how things work. As much as I hate to use this phrase, I'm like a systems thinker. And there are not too many systems out there that I think are quirkier or stranger.
Our market is so opaque. We're supposed to make it as opaque as possible.
Yeah.
This is the...
It's right. I mean, there are so many things that you could tell people who aren't in the art world about the way that the art market works, and they would just stare at you like you'd walked off a spaceship. Go,
that can't be.
It can't be like that. Like, really, it is.
It is. It is so. So we often said that, you know, an art market hold hand in hand with the economy. What's your comment about this?
I think that the art market in general, art economics, are always downstream of larger economics. And there are big obvious things that make that true, just in terms of, like, how's the stock market doing? What's the general macroeconomic?
Like now, with the interest rate going up, the art market is down. Look at the auction market.
Right, except as we're recording this, the U.S. Federal Reserve is meeting, and they're going to lower interest rates.
Lower, but
It's still high.
It's still high, but there's a hope of the interest rate being decreasing.
Right.
So we have to see all that.
So that impacts things. Then you get into smaller, even less sexy aspects of it, like tariffs, VAT, all these kinds of things. Like, all of those governmental policies end up playing into the way that art or any other good can trade between countries, especially now that, as we're talking about, it's a global art world. You have to think about things that you didn't used to have to, say, 30, 40 years ago, or at least think about as much.
So when you're first writing about art market, when you do your analysis compared to today, you're doing analysis of the art market, were there a big difference? Because today is really a global impact, and also there's technology impact, there is geopolitical politics, and all that affect the market.
It does, and I think that there are aspects of it that have changed significantly, and I think that there are also aspects of it that really haven't, and probably won't ever, honestly.
Like examples.
So one of the core beliefs that I have about understanding how all this stuff works is that if you want to understand the art market, you have to understand the social aspect of it almost before everything else. Because if you strictly look at it in terms of business, operations, how technology should fit into this, all these kinds of things, you're only going to be able to get so far. Because if you don't understand the sort of social norms, if you don't understand how much of this is as much about giving people things to put on their social calendars, sort of charting their year around particular places they want to be, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, let's start talking about the reasons of why people collect art, right? So, of course, we always talk about people start collecting art beside investment, beside, you know, you really love art, you want to collect art. It is a legacy that you want to create. Or the third is, you want, because my next door neighbor or my friend bought a piece of work, so I want to be in that social crowd. Therefore, I have to buy something. Maybe my ego is even bigger, so I want to buy a bigger piece. I mean, that seems to be the general reason of all the collectors all over the world buying it. Would you agree with that?
I think those are all very important pillars. I think increasingly you also have to talk about the financialization of it.
Of course.
But
the investment is today, as I always explain to a lot of my collectors, and I said, look, I mean, I understand there's 99.9% of the people are investment, are really purely about investment. Very few people will buy from the heart and the soul, which is beautiful. So, you know, even 10 years ago, people are a lot less blatant to talk about, to look at the auction market, but today is really blatantly, they just do the comparison the numbers comparison. So I think the whole world is doing the same thing, especially for investment purposes, especially in Asia, is really hugely about that. But now, do you see there's big difference nowadays compared to 10 years ago?
I'm trying to think of what little capsule judgment I could give you on this, because there are so many things that we could talk about. I think that what you just said is really important. I think that the willingness of people to be more explicit about the investment side of their interest in the arts, that I think has been a dramatic difference over the course of the past.
I think it's also private bankers now is advising a lot of clients. 10% of their asset they put in artworks. But I don't know whether this will affect, people buying artworks based on investment. I constantly was thinking about it, because it's never been such a big thing about private bankers advising their clients to put 10% of their asset into artworks. Would you think that this is one of the reasons as well?
I think that that makes a huge difference. Obviously, the makeup of the people who are buying the art, and obviously whoever has their ear, that ends up playing a big role in what types of work get bought, how often they get bought, where things are being bought, and just as importantly, as you know, I'm sure as a dealer who has a roster full of artists that you want to take care of, how quickly they're selling it again, too. So that is definitely true. Like, the speed of it, the willingness to just be upfront and blunt about, listen, I'm going to invest this amount of money. I'm going to expect that I can get this much back. I don't think that you were getting as much of that 10 years ago. That said,
but art is never, I mean, it's not as liquid as shares.
No.
It's a complete different, you know, ball game. But art can go up much, much higher than the shares, that's for sure. But it's always, I always thought the art market is manipulated.
Yeah, it's, and I think that it's important to understand just how small it still is.
Yes, absolutely. It's even the numbers are big, but the people, the players are only a handful.
Right.
Yeah. It's really a handful of players who really determine the art market.
Yes. And I think that a lot of this gets back to one of the other things that I look at a lot in my own writing is trying to step away from sort of whatever the art world thinks about itself and think about it in a broader context. Because even if we just talk about the numbers. So how many times have you heard this year already, oh, the Art Basel and UBS Art Market Report says $65 billion in annual sales, $68 billion, whatever it is. That sounds like a lot of money if you don't have any other reference point. The $65, $68 billion, that's about the same size as the American pet food industry. That's about the same set of sales every year. So if you think about it in that context, it's actually not very much.
It's not big.
Then that helps you get inside of the idea of what you just said, which is, yes, billions of dollars, but really how many people are able to sort of impact that, and especially impact it in a way that benefits themselves as opposed to just the general public or whatever else. And it is very small.
Very small. Absolutely. Absolutely. And can you share some more thoughts of what you are thinking about this art market, especially in relationship? I know you published a book talking about technology, the impact of technology on the art market.
Technology is a really interesting question when it comes to this space, I think, because the art world likes to think of itself as being extremely cutting edge, extremely open-minded, very creative, and all these types of things. But there's been very little sort of meaningful engagement with technology, at least on the business side. Like, I think that one of the things that gets overlooked...
Oh, yes, you have. Come on, the NFT?
How do you deal with NFTs?
I did.
You did?
We did. We did launch to NFT, but we then decided that we are really not professional enough to launch the NFT, that we have to work with different platforms. those platforms specialized, they knew how to market NFT. But to do NFT is, again, a very different thing, because NFT is not like artworks. You have, you can create credentials, you're using institution to create credentials. NFT is purely about money making. It's a pure money making thing. And that you know that sooner or later, it may crash because there's nothing substantial that can support that and that market. So after two times we did the NFT, the third one we are planning to do it, then we went and worked with another platform. So they did a lot of, and then I understand how they do the marketing. They have their, you know, it's really about the crypto world, which I don't know enough about cryptocurrency, the crypto world. But then just when we were ready to release, the market crash.
Crash.
But I think one expect that, I didn't expect that the NFT would crash, but I didn't expect that it will crash at, you know, so soon, because I always look at something that, if you want to invest in something, because NFT is all about money investment. But if you do about money investment, there's nothing substantial to support it. Then the problem starts.
Right.
So that's how I, you know, but I don't know enough about NFT to give further comments about it. But that was wild. And, you know, everybody left, right and center, everybody was doing NFT. Everyone. And the auction house has the NFT section as well.
Right. Sotheby's Metaverse still exists.
Yeah.
It's a dedicated.
Yeah. But I think Metaverse eventually still has to be important, because it's about technology. It's about the young. It's about Gen Z.
Well, what I would say is that I think that one aspect of technology and art that gets overlooked a lot is how much technology and the sort of digital landscape has changed the amount of information that's out there, the amount of research that people can do into artworks and just what's going on in the art world. Social media actually has ended up being, well, and I think 10 years ago about the conversation about Instagram in the art world, people were like, oh, you can sell things on Instagram. This is going to open up this whole thing. And there is some amount of that.
I know, because there's a lot of artists are selling through Instagram.
Right.
And a lot of galleries are finding artists in Instagram.
Right. And that's what I think is more important, is the kind of taste-making and discovery aspect of this.
Absolutely, because it seems that before, I think, you know, artists, we are always using curators and very elite, I mean, having the elite taste to choose the artist. But now, because of the Instagram, it's a popularity.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And you have these figures, whether they're artists or whether they are these kind of intermediaries or whoever else, who are constantly posting about what they're doing, who they're seeing, what works they're excited about, and it just immediately gets blasted out to a much larger audience than you would have ever had in the past. I mean, if you wanted to try to really expose an artist on your roster to the largest number of people in, say, 2008, let's say, what would you do? Like, how could you get something? There's no way that you could really do anything that would be as instantaneous as doing an Instagram post about it. And I think that that really gets underplayed in terms of how the communication and the sort of, I don't know, the taste of the art market has changed over the years.
But don't you think that this is because that, you know, the art market before, we are always saying that it is very elitist. And now the art market has been democratized. So, especially now with the Instagram and how everything is being marketed, and it's all about popularity. And do you think that technology has actually democratized the art market?
I think it has managed to do some amount of democratization. I don't think that it has fundamentally changed where the core of the business
But contemporary art market has actually grown really several folds since 2000.
Since 2000, but not in the past 10 years.
Of course. But 2000 to 2007 and mm-hmm. 8, I mean, before 2008, has grown enormously.
Right. And to me, I think that has more to do with geography than it does with technology.
China came in 2001. Yes. It's not even the first decades. The second decades where the art market really grown is because of Asia. But the first decade is already grown a lot because, I mean, if you look at that, is all master is completely, the numbers has gone down, but the post-war contemporary has gone up. So the art market has shifted.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And there are other things that were happening in that period of time that you're talking about too, like the number of art fairs that get held every year has grown dramatically.
Absolutely.
During that
absolutely.
Time. And again, like that's a geopolitical thing more than it is a technological thing.
You were just mentioning about these social functions like art fairs and all that. Do you think that is a very, how would I say, that is one of the attractions for these people, you know, using the excuse of collecting art, but is actually joining the community?
I think that there is definitely an element of that. I don't think that it's really different from deciding like, oh, maybe I should learn how to play golf because a lot of deals get done on golf courses. Yeah. Or there are a number of events outside of the art world that very wealthy people, very powerful people all go to, and it's as much a networking event as anything else. Like you see people go to Wimbledon, you see people go to LA for the Oscars or whatever else,
right.
Davos. I mean, all of these things are these sorts of connection points.
Yeah.
And I think that art fairs have definitely become one of those things. And I think that there's probably more intersection between the art world elite and the kind of larger world elite now than there used to be a few decades back.
I also always thought that when someone wants to make their name in a society, to become an art collector is much easier. And also to show social networking. As soon as you became, you know, like a huge collector buying a certain amount, I mean, a big price tag of a painting, immediately your name is known. Do you think that this is one of the reasons that there are so many people is getting, you know, especially the people who's well off coming into and joining and being interested in art?
Absolutely. And I think that there's always been some elements of that. Even if you go back to the early 1900s, you look at the robber barons and you had people like Henry Clay Frick or whoever else coming in being like, oh, in order to show that I'm cultured and that I belong, what I need to do is to collect art, because the other people who are already in this world and who are operating at this level, they collect art too. So I want to have the same kinds of things that they have. So then we have something in common, and then I can show that I belong, basically. And I think that that's still going on. That's always going to go on as long as we continue to make and sell art.
Today is a global art world. So this global art world, first, all of a sudden, I mean, of course, I mean, politics, sociology, 10 years ago, we talk about diversity. We talk about women's art. I remember more than 10 years ago when I came here, everybody was talking about women's art has been underrated. And then all of a sudden on that trip, particularly when I was in New York, I felt that, wow, I think next 10 years, all the museum will be showing a lot of women artists. Surely enough, yes, galleries and all that. So the diversity also brought in African art, right? So this global phenomenon of different culture, you know, global culture recognizing, how do you feel about that? I mean, the art movement?
I think that at its best, art really has the capacity to introduce a wider population to voices and ideas that they otherwise wouldn't encounter. And that's a really important aspect of things. And there's a difference between sort of being able to show work in a museum and having it sell for a lot of money. Those are not, they're related often, but they're not necessarily the same thing. And I think that what we've seen again over the course of the past 10 years or so is that there's been a kind of merger between those two things where there has been a larger awareness that we need to sort of understand more about what's happening outside of ourselves, whether it's different cultures, different ethnicities, different genders, whatever. And there is a way in which I think that the people who have some amount of power in the art world have really tried to make that happen to a certain extent. And we can talk about how effective it's been in the long run, but at the very least, there was an acknowledgement, it has been an acknowledgement that we need to kind of expand the spectrum of who gets heard, who gets seen. And I think that's important.
I think that, and I also believe in cultural dialogue, you know, to all of a sudden, to give that platform to places like African art we never seen, we would never have a chance to understand their background, their history, and all that was really exciting. And did you see that coming with these African art from Africa, not American, I mean, African-American, right, but in Africa?
Did I see it coming?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think that I didn't have a specific prediction about it, put it that way. But I think this is another way in which, if you look at the wider cultural sphere, there were ways that you could have seen it coming. Like, if you look at, say, music, for instance, the interest in sort of global pop, for lack of a better term, like, there's been a lot of interest, especially in the past several years, about, like, forms of pop music that are coming up within African countries.
Afrobeats.
And Amapiano and some other things. And that gets sort of integrated into what becomes mainstream pop in the West and all those other kinds of things. And, like, that's, there's no reason that should be unique to music or any other art form. I think it's a sort of global awareness that's out there. And so, of course, it was going to happen in the art world. It's just a question of when and exactly how and who those people were going to be.
Let's talk about politics, right?
Okay.
Geopolitics and how this geopolitics have affected art world. Now, there's a very strong anti-China moment. So what we see is people has lost interest in collecting Chinese art. And there was a complete, if you go to auctions, I can only see it from, because it's a public knowledge, as an auction is people are losing interest in Chinese art in auctions. And also, when you go to America, there's much less Chinese artists exhibition. Is actually, I wouldn't even think that there is, as of today, any Chinese artists from mainland China exhibition in America or in Western Europe in a main way. What do you think about it?
Well, I mean, again, I think you're absolutely right in that it is reflective of sort of larger tensions that are there. Obviously, like, there's effectively been a trade war going on between the U.S. and China for 6 years.
But I always thought that, you know, art, culture, soft power, it should not be really affecting that to that extent, which is, I remember one of the director of an institution said to me, you know, to show Chinese art today is politically incorrect. This is in America, which is pretty shocking to hear for such comments.
Right. It's very reductive too. I mean, the idea that,
you know, remember, like, you know, a few years ago, Chinese art is so hot. For such a long time, and all of a sudden it's just everybody is not touching it or looking at it in a complete different way, for me, is a little bit shocking.
Right. Yeah. And I think that maybe I'm just a little bit more of a pessimist in terms of how much those other considerations end up determining the way that things happen in the art world. Again, like, even if we just want to talk about tariffs that you have to pay to import art from China or vice versa at this point, that's going to go in, especially when we're in a larger economy that is not particularly encouraging in a lot of ways right now. If somebody's looking at a Chinese artist's work and they're like, well, I'm gonna have to pay an extra 7.5% to whatever to be able to get this work here, I don't know, can my margin support that right now? Maybe I'll look at somebody else. Maybe I'll look at a domestic artist instead, or whatever. So that's one side of it. But what I would see on the other side...
But I know that American artists going into China is huge. It's a huge tax. So that is why most of the transaction is done in Hong Kong.
Right. And from the standpoint of Hong Kong, there is still a lot of investment into that space. Like, Christie's is, in another day or two, about to open this grand new headquarters that they have in Hong Kong. Sotheby's just opened this new space there over the summer.
So, it's really pretty crazy, that place.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, it's like a shopping mall for art.
Right. Yeah, I hope that I get a chance to see it in person, because it looks fascinating.
It's fascinating. You know, it's completely changed your whole dynamic about art, because you would never think that. You know, it's like different booths. And it's not even booths, you know. You have sculptures, you have couture dresses, side by side. I think when your art market is down, so they're trying different ways to see how people now is receiving art. And also in Hong Kong especially, we haven't had such a big art crowd. It's only started, I think, when we first have the Art Hong Kong, which is starting from 2008. So it's really very, very new. It's not even 20 years. So it's pretty funny when you see that.
Yeah, I'm curious, from the standpoint of your interactions with collectors, like, do you feel like you've felt more of a shift in terms of people approaching art more from almost like a luxury retail standpoint? Or is that... Yes.
Okay. Depending on the price point.
Yeah.
Depending on the price point. When you go to Sotheby's there, it's... They only see it as a luxury, you know? You go to an antique shop, you go to shops, you just buy things. They're selling things between 5,000 Hong Kong, which is like... How much is it? It's around... around 8,000, between 7,000 and 8,000 US, to around 30,000 US. It's around that range. So people go say, yeah, just buy a piece, and it's like luxury.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Exactly what you said. So they made it, you know, in the art gallery. When you walk into an art gallery, it's intimidating, right? So when you go there, it's completely different. You just feel that, you know, it's like shopping.
Right.
I don't know. Up to now, I don't know how I feel about it. I mean, is it the new world is changing? I don't know. I have to go back several times, and then I will understand a little bit more. I don't know whether this concept, when it puts in Western Europe or America, would it work. Maybe it will. I don't know. Because price point is, I mean, there are prints fair, right?
Sure.
There are prints fair. So it works more or less the same. But in prints fair, it's just prints.
Right.
But there you have decorative art, you have design, you have art, it puts everything together. But in a very traditional way of hierarchy of art forms, you don't put everything together.
Right.
So this is a completely new thing, but I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah, we'll see.
Because I think the younger generation is looking at art very, very differently from how we appreciate art as well. I mean, the Gen Z especially, to entice the Gen Z, you know that too. And even to visit the museum is very different because they like their sort of chosen art, their popular art. They may not like the art, the artworks or the art that's curated. They don't even have time to read. They don't have the patience to read. So it's, you know, it's a complete different takes from what we appreciate.
Right, and I think that that's one of the big challenges.
Huge challenges for the next generations, the Gen Z generation, and the generation beyond Gen Z. So we really do not, I think the museum are changing a lot to, you know, you have Corsica, right? And you have museum who would take in popular artists to sell tickets. Because if they don't have enough funding, you have to sell tickets. So you also have immersive art that in many of the very old establishment, they wouldn't even take immersive art. So they have to open because they want to entice the younger generation. I think all that is changing. So whether the art market is going to change, I don't know. How do you think about Gen Z? And when it comes to the Gen Z who has sufficient finance power, would they still collect the same way as our generation?
I think there are going to be some real adjustments that are going to happen.
I think so as well.
And that's going to be the big challenge for me. I think that we've been trapped in this sort of feedback loop, in my mind, where you've heard a lot of sellers of art say like, oh, we really need to open up, we need to find new audiences, we have to
absolutely.
And that is absolutely true. But then the opposite side of it is, well, are you willing to meet them on their own terms, or do you want them to just do it the same way that the previous generations have always done it? And if the answer is, well, we want new people, but we don't really want to change anything too much about what we're doing in order to get them, that conversation is a non-starter. So people are going to have to just acknowledge that a younger generation that is about to inherit a tremendous amount of wealth may not want to do things the way that the previous generation did. And I think the people who are willing to acknowledge that and to meet them halfway are going to fare a lot better than the people who are going to say, well, yes, we would love to have new clients, but...
I mean, I felt very, you know... And honestly, I think most of the gallerists, they are pushing a corner to whether you are going to continue the old way, because I understand a lot of new collectors coming in. I mean, with one artist we have a lot of new collectors coming in. And that artist is not a museum supported artist, because they don't do it, they don't create art based on a concept. I mean, it's very simple. I want to make art that makes people happy. I mean, in any curatorial things, they think rubbish, you know.
Right.
You're thinking of your... But they attract, and they attract not just people buying art, but viewers coming into the galleries, non-stop looking at these are an artwork. I mean, this is what we want. We want galleries to have more visitors, not just about buying art. I mean, of course, it's all change. And then you take in these new collectors who buy that sort of art. Would they be more interested to look at our other artists? No interest.
Really, none.
We actually give them even, you know, a different experience. We take them around. We even have two artists talking, you know, with the artists they did like. But I think it takes step by step. Mm-hmm. The older generation, because they have the very young ones who is in their 20s, they buy smaller works. Older ones, they have the money to buy. They buy bigger works. The older ones may be able to convert. But the young one, the attention span is so short. So it's really different. And even when we do in Instagram, right? We have like Instagram with the artists speaking about their own work. You see very few viewers, but very short videos about really, you know, action doing that, lots of viewers. So all that you understand that, wow, you know, maybe we are, you know, maybe we have to adapt. So it's very strange. It's a strange world. But people who buys, who collects, a lot of people who collects, you know, seriously collect, they may not even look at Instagram.
Right.
Right? I mean, serious collector, many serious collector of whom I know, they don't even look at Instagram.
Right. Right. And so yeah. you have to think about how to communicate differently, yes, exactly, to different audiences. And that requires a kind of layer of, I don't know, strategy that didn't used to be there
before. Yeah. So let me also ask you, social media.
Yes.
Does social media impact on art market? And if it does, how big do you think that it has impacted? Or would it grow? You know, would that impact grow?
I think it's had a huge impact, but again, not necessarily in terms of, oh, this is a tremendously valuable new sales channel that's opened up. I think
it's not about money, right? It's
not so much. Attention. There's some of that, but yes, it is largely about attention. It's about the way that information circulates. It's about discovery. It's about all these things that used to be harder to do on a mass scale than what they are now. But I mean, it's really telling too, in terms of what you were just talking about, as far as who is able to get a very large audience and who isn't. Like, there are some artists out there who are not, to use your phrase, which I think is very wise, museum-supported artists, who have more followers on Instagram than like major museums.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And that, I think, is indicative of the fact that they are tapping into something that is fundamentally different than what people who were used to kind of an earlier era are tapping into. And again, it becomes this question of like, well, do you have to do that? Or is it a choice? And either way, like, what is it that you want to accomplish? Do you want to try to be known among the largest group of people, among all age groups or whatever? Or are you just going to say, here's an audience that I'm interested in serving. It's a smaller audience, but it's an audience that I understand. It's an audience that I feel like my artists will do particularly well with. And I'm just going to stay rigorously attached to that. And that's enough for me. That's a choice that every art seller is going to have to make.
But if you want to have longevity, you know, we are talking about artists' longevity. I mean, if the Gen Z taste has changed, the longevity of certain artists could not grow. I mean, we always talk about, I mean, what makes artwork important is the longevity. But if the taste level is all changed, how can we preserve that?
Well, I think that institutions still matter.
Of course, institutions definitely matter. But if the new trustees going in, and you know, it's not today's trustees, of course, this younger generation would one day become the trustees, and they would have brought in a complete different taste. That your museum will be changed as well. The curators will be changing as well, right?
I think that is very probable. But like, I think every museum is probably a sort of push and pull between those forces.
Because yes, not like, I know.
Yeah,
I know.
Certainly. Yeah. I'm sure you can deal with more museums every day than I do, sure.
Yeah.
But there is that same kind of like generational tension within institutions as there is in the larger art world, too. So it's going to take a few decades. Like, there are some trustees that are going to come in, but it's not going to be like all of a sudden 2030 shifts over and it's like, oh, no trustees under the age of 40.
I think in two decades away, there will be a major change. But I don't know how drastic the change will be. because I can see the Gen Z is completely having different tastes. The lifestyle is very different. So that will affect culture, because the contemporary culture in 20 years time will be vastly different from our culture today. So that will be, I don't know what is going to happen. Maybe I always say that, do believe in this, because now today is AI, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we're talking about conceptual art. Conceptual art, you don't need to paint yourself, you don't need to create yourself. But all that, and AI could have done it. So would that be in 20 years time? Having the craft to do it yourself would become more valuable.
I hope that's true.
Yeah, because I was thinking about it. You know, I think, you know, I mean, with this whole world about hierarchy of art form, I mean, with craft being put at such low value, it's completely unacceptable. So I believe that, I'm actually thinking about in 20 years time, all that will change.
I think it's a big question
Big question.
It's a huge question. And I am actually weirdly optimistic about this, and I'm not known for my optimism in general, but I think that the predictions that you'll see out there in terms of like AI is going to take over everything, it's going to put all these artists out of jobs, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think
it's ticking about the job, but I think the whole dynamics will change. Mm-hmm. I think the dynamics of not respecting craft, I think is a big problem. All right. So to revert that is actually not a bad thing.
No, and I think that that's to some extent already happening. I mean, the most prominent input that we're seeing from AI, the most prominent output that we're seeing from AI in art is now a genre that is literally referred to as AI slop. Everyone sees it and thinks it looks like garbage, because it mostly does. Like it's like high production value garbage, but there's no way that you're going to look at it and be like, oh, I would rather have this on my wall than a great painting, a great sculpture. So I think that's, it's already happening. It's sort of on some level putting us back in touch with the importance of actual human thought, human production, human excellence, and I hope that continues.
One last question I want to ask you. I read one of your article about Birkenbag.
Yes.
Yes. I think that was very interesting.
Thank you.
Why don't you just elaborate this and tell the audience about that?
So the story was about how there was a class action lawsuit against Hermès that was filed in California over the way that Birkenbags are sold. And for people who are not deep in the luxury resale.
Yeah, if they don't spend enough, you cannot get a Birkenbag. Exactly. And even if you spend enough, you get a Birkenbag, you can't choose. They may give you a platinum Birkenbag and you have to buy it.
Right, exactly. And this sounds an awful lot like the way that our
galleries,
right, dole out the works of their most popular artists. And so I just talked to some antitrust lawyers, basically, to try to figure out whether this...
Just to let the audience know, is in galleries, we usually take our paintings, especially the A-grade paintings. We would keep it inside the viewing room because we want to sell it to the institutions or big collectors who can enhance the credibility of the artist. And also we sell to whoever we choose to sell to.
Right. Yeah. So the question was basically, is this something that art dealers who do that kind of sales should worry about? And the answer that I got back was actually no. Like, there are a whole bunch of legal nuances that we could go into about this, but the gist is that at this point, there is no reason to expect that is a part of the art world that is going to need to go away for legal reasons anytime soon.
I thought it was brilliant. Okay. It was brilliant that you draw the parallel.
Well, that, like I said, that's what I try to do. Yeah. I try to look at what else is happening that might apply to the art world that the art world isn't necessarily thinking about.
What a great session that I have this pleasure talking to you, Tim.
Thanks so much for having me, bro.
Thank you.